But nobody thinks that the promises of Brexit, the economic promises of Brexit, have been delivered. There was a time when Ukraine, in particular, and COVID masked the lack of beneficial economic consequences from Brexit. But that's all behind us now. If you want to know why I think, principally, opinion has changed towards Brexit over the past 3 or 4 years, it's because of the realization that there are no economic bonuses coming from it. And in particular, there's no improvement of public services.
Hello, I'm John Stevens. I'm the chair of the Federal Trust, and I'm talking once again to Brendan Donnelly at the Federal Trust about developments in the UK relating to Brexit. Brendan, we just had the 5th anniversary of Brexit, and I was wondering how you saw the key arguments that were made for Brexit during the referendum campaign and thereafter, how they stand up now in terms of public opinion and the public debate. And starting perhaps with the key argument about Brexit being necessary to improve our trade and our growth performance. How does that look after 5 years of experiencing it?
I think that's an aspect of the Brexit debate which has aged very, very poorly. I think that there's almost universal recognition in the United Kingdom now that Brexit has made no beneficial difference to growth or economic prospects. On the contrary, there is debate about precisely how hard this Brexit has borne upon trade and growth, but nobody thinks that the promises of Brexit, the economic promises of Brexit, have been delivered. There was a time when Ukraine, in particular, and COVID masked the lack of beneficial economic consequences from Brexit. But that's all behind us now. If you want to know why, I think, principally, opinion has changed towards Brexit over the past 3 or 4 years. It's because of the realization that there are no economic bonuses coming from it. And in particular, there's no improvement of public services.
Another key argument for Brexit was the whole question of immigration. And there was a time after the referendum, although before I think we actually left, when immigration went right down the agenda, having been very prominent at the time of the referendum as an issue in public concern, went right down the agenda. But it's now come back very powerfully, and it's in fact given a sort of a new life to one of the key figures of the referendum campaign on the Leave side, Nigel Farage, who is now with his Reform Party, riding very high precisely on this issue, which is rather curious because, in many respects, Brexit has actually made the immigration issue much more difficult to resolve and much more serious.
The implications of Brexit, the consequences of Brexit for the whole question of migration, as you say, have been very, very different from what have been predicted. The whole debate, however, over migration, immigration, asylum seeking was hopelessly confused during Brexit and to a certain extent since. The United Kingdom needs legal migration as part of its economic structures and model. And the question is, where do these migrant workers come from? When we were in the European Union, there was a very beneficial economic model for migration, which was called freedom of movement, that you'd have people from principally Eastern Europe, Middle and Eastern Europe, who came to this country for a few years, got some money, went back to their own country and spent the rest of their lives perhaps taking advantage of the skills that they'd left here. Now the migration pattern is rather different. There are people who come with their families and who intend to remain in the United Kingdom indefinitely and perfectly legitimately to call, as they get older, more and more on British social services. It turns out that the Brexiters didn't believe in the free market, and the figures which have been widely presented of higher migration into the United Kingdom after Brexit than before has been very damaging to the image of Brexit within the United Kingdom. And I'd say it's the second most important reason why the opinion polls showed so much unpopularity now for Brexit.
It does seem that the last resort of advocates of Brexit has been to say that it was fundamentally not about trade or growth or even immigration, but it was about sovereignty. It was about the power of Parliament to make the laws under which we live without foreign interference. And that, or even though Brexit may be not the success that people hoped for, nevertheless, it is now our responsibility. We now have to deal with the problems ourselves, and this is bracing, and that this is a huge restoration of the status of parliamentary democracy. Well, how does that argument look now?
I don't think it was ever a particularly powerful argument in the first place. If that was the best argument or the main argument of the people wanting supporting Brexit in 2016, they wouldn't have spent the millions and the hours that they did talking about how economic prosperity was just around the corner. There was going to be all this extra money for the NHS. I've always taken the view that the British electorate don't regard sovereignty as something which is to be weighed out in ingots of gold. It's a question of what you do with it. And what you do with it is to improve the economic and social conditions of the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, since Brexit, has been very chary indeed about diverging from European standards. And that's rationally so because it's our biggest market. And if we want to allow the best possible access to that market, then obviously we've got to continue mimicking European standards. Standards which, by the way, we originally had a great deal of say in setting up. When people talk about sovereignty and vis-a-vis the European Union, they often forget that one of the motivating forces within the European Union was the United Kingdom. We played, I don't like the phrase, punching above our weight, because that means you tend to get your teeth knocked off. But we did make a major contribution to the way the European Union developed, and it was no hardship, in fact, to live within those regulations.
But behind that notion of restoring sovereignty was this sense that the Brexiteers were the people who truly believed in Britain, and that people who were in favour of staying in the European Union somehow didn't, were somehow less patriotic. And this sense that Brexit should release a revival of British consciousness was surely a part of the argument. But of course, it had one problem, which was the impact of Brexit on the Union, on the component parts of the United Kingdom, notably Ireland, Northern Ireland, and Scotland. How has the debate gone there, relating to Brexit, and where might it lead?
I was amused to see that Keir Starmer had put out a tweet just before the Six Nations rugby tournament began, wishing good luck to all the home nations. That's doubly amusing. First, there's an All-Ireland team which plays rugby. I don't know whether he thinks that they're a home team. And secondly, most of the Six Nations tournament consists of bits of the United Kingdom kicking lumps out of each other in the hope of lifting the trophy. So it's a very odd example of Britishness to have chosen. But I think that seriously, Britishness is more at risk, more at question as a result of Brexit than it ever was before. I'm not saying that a united Ireland is just around the corner, but certainly Brexit has contributed to making the current arrangements of Northern Ireland less plausible, less credible, less relevant, and that's been reinforced by the arrangements after Brexit. Scotland, of course, even though the National Party find themselves in the doldrums at the moment, very much continues to be divided between those who want to remain in the Union and those who don't. Even in Wales, there's been an uptick, a significant uptick of feeling that Wales should have more of an autonomous say over its own future. I think that more or less consciously, those people who don't live in England have come to the conclusion that Brexit is a phenomenon of English exceptionalism. And that's the basis on which it was forced through intellectually and politically. And I'm not sure that that's a stable compound or a position that's going to be sustainable in the medium term. And Brexit has injected an enormous element of instability into that.
So what you're painting is a picture of fairly comprehensive disillusionment with the pillars that constituted the Leave campaign in 2016. And where does that lead a solution to come? I mean, is there really, beside this discontent with Brexit and the feeling that it hasn't been a success, a genuine desire to rejoin the European Union? Is there a sense that we have to get much closer to the EU now?
I think that there is certainly a sense that we have to get much closer to the EU now. And I think that overwhelmingly, the election of Donald Trump and his likely behaviour towards the European Union is only going to reinforce that sense. Whether we're yet at the position where there is an autonomous public pressure for rejoining the structures of the European Union, I think it is a more open question. I was very interested to see that Ed Davey is now proposing a formal institutional link with the European Union of joining the customs union. I think, for reasons that we've explored before, it's quite unlikely that it would be possible to do that sort of cherry picking. But it's a very interesting first indication that a major political party, British political party, is coming to think that there may be votes to be gained from advocating institutional links with the European Union. And I think that that's a process that can only continue. We're 5 years on, as you say. We're probably, in the development of public opinion, more than halfway down the road to saying we ought to rejoin. Now, there won't be an absolute majority, well, maybe a majority, but there won't be 100% of the United Kingdom that ever wants to rejoin the European Union. But I think that we are shaping up over the coming years for there being a sufficiently strong majority and a majority which is exercised by the European question for politicians to feel the pressure, the electoral pressure of attempting implausibly to make Europe the Brexit work, or simply sticking on by Brexit and saying it'll work in 50 years' time.
Nevertheless, the advent of Donald Trump has given some support in anti-European circles in Britain for an American alternative to the EU. And it does seem that the present government is seeking some form of trade deal with the United States and hopes to somehow remain outside any trade war that might arise between the United States and the EU, which seems to be in prospect. Where does this American dimension play into a sense that Brexit has failed and that we should be getting closer to the European Union again?
Trump is deeply unpopular in this country. He's added a new layer to anti-American feeling. When you talked about the intellectual background to the Brexit referendum in 2016, there were people there within the Conservative Party in particular. There was a tranche of opinion formers who did think that Brexit would be an opportunity to make the United Kingdom more like America, socially and politically. But their views were very much silenced by the people running the Leave campaign because they knew how unpopular such sentiments were once they were subjected to realistic scrutiny. If you want to be nearer the United States of America, then it's a very odd campaign slogan to have evolved in 2016, saying we want £400 million a week more for the National Health Service. Because if there's one iconic representative of the difference between the American system and the British system. It's precisely in socialized medicine, as they call it, or the free provision of public health, as we would say it. So I think that one shouldn't imagine that this pro-American, pro unbridled free market sentiment is one that's widely held within the United Kingdom. It is one that does have a certain resonance in some circles, political circles, and it has a resonance in certain sections of the mass media. But I doubt very, very much whether those people who are telling opinion polls at the moment that they would vote for reform do so because they think that Nigel Farage is going to turn the United Kingdom into a simulacrum of the United States of America.
But how do we explain, therefore, the rise of reform and the fact that it is now, in some opinion polls, ahead of the other parties? Or you've got a situation where reform, the Labour Party, and the Conservative Party are all roughly in the same position in the low 20s. This is a very curious situation and seems to run counter to the fact that Brexit, which after all is the policy which made Nigel Farage and the Reform Party is entirely a remaking of the old UKIP and Brexit parties, that they are rising. Nevertheless, the opinion in the country is generally recognising that Brexit was a mistake. Seems very odd.
It is very odd indeed, and it's reinforced by the vagaries of the first past the post system. We wouldn't have the political party structure that we have but for the first past the post system. I suspect that it's Brexit which, in different ways, has destroyed the traditional coalitions of both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. It's more clear cut as far as the Conservative Party is concerned. To give up the freedom, the economic freedom, and the political solidarity which was implicit in the European Union, was something which the Conservative Party really could never digest. It was something that it thought was a good idea. But it's turned out to be a revolution which is eating not merely its children, but its parents. Labour, I think, are in somewhat of the same position. Everybody in the Labour Party, I'm sure including Keir Starmer, knows and recognises that Brexit hasn't worked. And yet they think that it's to their electoral advantage that there's a small but decisive segment of political opinion that will be swayed by too pro-European an attitude and swayed against the Labour Party. So the Labour Party finds itself on this main issue of the day, facing in both ways at the same direction. And that's something which permeates the whole of the political ambiguity, in my view, of the present Labour government. It is quite extraordinary that you have a Labour government that says it's going to go for growth by getting rid of regulation. Now, I don't dispute for a moment that regulations in some circumstances can be inimical to growth, but the thought that generally regulation by the state is a bad thing. It's something which is only to be seen as a chain on enterprise. Well, that's a view and an analysis with which Donald Trump would be fully at home. How can a party aspiring to represent the centre left associate itself so firmly with such a philosophy?
And that phenomenon is underpinned by reform targeting and having apparent success in areas which traditionally were Labour supporting constituencies. And in a sense, what's happened is that the Conservative Party, because of Brexit, and this was very clear in the 2019 general election, sort of shifted from being a party of the educated and prosperous, broadly speaking, middle class, to becoming more and more a working class party, whereas the Labour Party was going in the opposite direction. So we have a sort of inversion of the political basis of both parties.
Yes, but it's one that is not recognised in any systematic way by the people leading those parties. And reform is plunging into the gaps, the intellectual vacuum, which surrounded on left and right. Would you say that Reform is a right-wing party or a left-wing party? It's not easy to say. It's simply something which is reflecting and taking advantage of the two vacuums that surround it.
So how can the UK escape this trap which it has created for itself? Does it require electoral reform as part of the process of reversing Brexit?
Certainly in the longer term it does, but whether it needs electoral reform before the process of reversing Brexit has begun, I think is another issue. What I think is the most likely outcome of the next general election is that Labour will be the biggest party, but they won't be able to govern without the Liberal Democrats. And I think that by that stage, both of those parties will have moved much more in a pro-EU direction. I don't think it's at all impossible that in the course of the next parliament, we have a referendum on rejoining the European Union as a result of that coalition.
Well, Brendan, thank you very much. It's a very good place to stop. We will continue these discussions in further videos in due course.
Thank you very much.